We've entered into the Enlightenment period and seen Montaigne's skepticism. And right about the time of Montaigne was a guy named by the name of Fontenelle. And he was writing a letter back and forth to this woman who had heard about Copernicus' theories and some of the scientific discoveries of Kepler and Tycho Brahe and so forth. And she wrote him a letter because she was kind of concerned that since the Earth was in motion and spinning and so forth, that she might go flying off the planet sometime, and was kind of wanting to know what it is that's keeping us all in place here. And if it's not divine forces or things of that sort, then, you know, what's to keep us all in place? So he wrote her back, and he said, don't worry, you know, you're fine. You're not going to be hurt. You're not going to fly off the planet or anything like that. You're going to be okay, because the Earth is, and the universe is like a giant clockwork, and everything is working according to laws of mechanics, and everything is working because the systems of natural laws are all integrated with one another, and it's all been running like this for a long time, just like a clock. And so there's no need for you to worry, because you're going to be okay. And she wrote back and said, I'm so comforted to know that after having read what you had to say about natural law and everything, that I'm in a very safe universe. And so she felt good, and he felt good, and the whole world felt good. The thing that I find interesting about Fontenelle's response was that he did not say that a clock is like the universe. He said the universe is like a clock. Now, that may not seem like a great big deal, but it is, because it shows something twisted about the mind of man, and that is that he places his own work forward as the real. Okay? I mean, you can go to Augsburg and watch that clock over there do all of its Punch and Judy show. But the universe is like that clock. Not that the clock is like the universe. Not like the work of man is like the work of God, but that the work of God is like the work of man. This is kind of the seed of Enlightenment thought. And out of that comes the idea that all things are matter in motion. Matter in motion. That explains everything. It explains how the universe runs. It explains how things, phenomena takes place on the earth. It even explains life itself. And that's all the explanation that you need. Everything is matter in motion. Matter in motion at all times. And there isn't any need for outside input. Now, this is the basis of the idea of deism. You haven't completely dropped God out of the picture yet, because you don't have a good enough excuse to do that. We all got here somehow or another, and God is the best explanation we've got so far, says the Enlightenment man. But he's not in the foreground anymore. We don't have to reckon with God as being in our way anymore. He got everything started like a clockmaker. Okay, God is like a clockmaker, or like the person who owns the clock. He has put everything in its proper place. the essence that is within it, the laws that are within it, are going to make everything operate. And all he needs to do is just wind it all up and then let it go. And so God is not necessary. Maybe he was necessary to start it, but he's not necessary to continue it. He's not necessary to control it. It will go on its own. And that is the deistic idea. The natural law idea, which comes out of basic school of Athens and comes out of Milesian philosophy and also comes out of pagan mythology, can be found embedded in all pagan mythology. The idea of natural law is probably one of the most powerful ideas in human thought. We can wrangle about a lot of things, but when it comes down to what the controller is the things that are endemic within itself. In other words, a planet has gravity. Planets have gravity because they are planets. They have mass. That mass causes gravity somehow or another. Not absolutely sure why. Nobody knows exactly what gravity is, whether it's gravitons or whether it's waves or whatever it may be. But it is a property of bodies to have attraction, and that is built into them, and it's necessarily built into them. In other words, God could not have done it any other way. Now, he may have known the essence was there when he made the substance, but he didn't necessarily make the substance. It's going to work. God does not have to attend it. He can walk away, leave it alone, and it'll go on his own, on its own. And this is the basic deistic principle. Now, if it works for deism, it definitely is going to work for materialism and naturalism. Materialism and naturalism are the ideas, is this very idea here, without even the necessity of God to have created all things. Because once evolution takes place, or once evolution is an idea that comes forward, then we've eliminated God as creator altogether. This didn't come about all at once. It went through phases. It took some time to get there. It had to go through some arguments that were going on back in the 1700s between what were called the catastrophists and the uniformitarianists. The catastrophists were those who believed that the world has gone through many catastrophes, many floods. They were called Neptunists. Has recreated itself over and over again. And these people are almost pure pagan in their view because these views are extremely old. And over against the Neptunists and the catastrophists, there were the uniformitarians like Lamarck, who take the view that if we're going to know anything, we can't have any surprises. There can't be any new occurrences that take place. We don't need unpredictability in the universe. It's got to be predictable. If it's not predictable, we'll not understand it. And so, therefore, if rationalism is to work, it's absolutely necessary that nothing essentially changes. Now, I want you to understand this about uniformitarianism. There's no proof of uniformitarianism whatsoever. It's simply a natural consequence of a rationalist point of view. If the rationalist says all that we need is our minds and all that we need is our senses and interpretation to be able to observe the things that take place in the world, see those things, see, smell, taste, feel, and hear those things, experience them, and then draw them into our minds, interpret them, think about them, synthesize those thoughts in scientific method or in logic, then we are going to be able to understand anything. We'll be able to comprehend and apprehend anything in particular. And that works just fine as long as everything stays essentially the same. But if anything ever changes, then our reasoning processes are going to be unpredictable. So therefore, everything has got to be like it is now. It always must have been the way it is right now. There couldn't have been great catastrophes. Everything had to stay pretty steady throughout most of time. And so that way we can understand all things. So you see how these ideas work off of one another. The natural consequence of catastrophism and the natural consequence of rationalism. So I want you to understand rationalism, uniformitarianism, what the relationship is between those two things. Rationalism, as we saw, began to play out over time. It doesn't explain everything, and it strips everything of meaning in time. Empiricism came up at the same time, the idea that we live within an environment and that within this environment that we live, we understand things because we experience things. Our experience of them, the exposure of things to our senses, our intuitions, and so forth are sufficient for us to learn as well. But the problem is that we can't be objective in that area. So what do you do? What do you do with all of that? Well, you try to synthesize the two. And the synthesis between those two is going to be what we call positivism. And I'm not going to get into that right now, but that is going to be the synthesis between those two things. Now, having covered that and the problems of rationalism and materialism, what we come up with is this. It's all here. It's all here. There isn't anything to receive from outside of this cosmos of thought that we have, the collection of things that we have. Reason is supreme. It can comprehend all things. Everything is in the world. All that's in the world of senses is sufficient for all understanding. And that's all we really need to get to know. And the concerns of the rationalist and materialist are, how do we know what we know? And we talked about that a little bit in the last time. What are some of the things that get in the way of the certainty of knowledge? Things like language and how we use language in thought. Because if we use language in thought, and something's wrong with language, which there is, and especially the English language, but if there's something wrong with language, then it's going to give us problems with our thought process. If it's not capable of being able to process the reasoning, then it's not going to be sufficient for our thought processes. So we need a language that we can use that's more pure, a language that we can use that actually is more precise. And so mathematics is that language. That's the hope, anyway. But how do you take mathematics and turn it into a language? And so philosophy is going to have to create its own language of philosophy, using the English language or whatever, but using the English language with mathematical forms. And so logic is going to be turned into formula, and you follow this formula when you're running your lines of reasoning through it. Does it work? Does it identify fallacies? Well, it does. It does work. But can you take that and turn it into reality? What's the gap between the objective and the subjective? How are we tainted in our knowledge? What kind of filters are there that's messing things up? What about our environment? What about how much that we've learned that's junk, and that we're integrating the junk that we've learned into our logical processes? What other things are adversely affecting our thought processes? This is the rationalist problem. We don't think perfectly. There are so many different things that are getting in the way of perfect thought. All right, so if this is the case, then how do we know that we are stringing our premises towards a proper conclusion? Because understand one thing about logic. You can string premises all day long, and you can do it perfectly and do it logically and be wrong in the end because you have gone in the wrong direction. You've used the wrong premises. You have taken the wrong direction in deductive and inductive reasoning. And so that can cause you problems in the end, and you can draw the wrong conclusions before you've reached a rational answer to whatever it is that you're dealing with. All right, science, mathematics, logic, are these going to do it? And there's problems with each one. What's the problem with science? Well, science may be a method, but there are also philosophies of science. And how many philosophies of science are there? Well, there's been many that have developed through science. I don't know whether you realize this or not, but science itself has evolved. That is, the concept of science has gone through several different interpretations of science leading up to the, to modern concepts of science. We've gone from rational science which has to cling very closely to the scientific method. Theoretical or hypothetical science, falsification in science, eclectic science, artistic science. There's just all kinds of sciences that have strung along over time. And there has been a shift away from propositional and objective science towards theoretical science. Today we are more theoreticians than they were in the 19th and 18th century. And theoretical models are more important to us now than it was to them back then. They wanted the proof. They wanted to take the thing to the proof and bring it from the proof to application. They wanted proof that they had arrived at the right answer. Nowadays, we're satisfied with theoretical models, all right? And we're having problems with those, too. I mean, we think about Einstein as being really, really brilliant, you know, and special relativity. But that's outmoded now. You know, quantum mechanics and so forth have come along. Other theories of physics have come along since then and have displaced it. So science itself keeps changing. And the so-called scientific rules are constantly being disproven, are constantly being, what were thought to be absolute rules at one time are not so absolute anymore. Because new things have been discovered or new directions have been taken in thought. So rationalism doesn't work. It doesn't work because it doesn't give the certainty that somebody like Montaigne wanted. So what do you do? What do you do? And man also doesn't like being controlled. He wants to control. So he wants a system of thought that gives him control. And empiricism, the idea of knowing intuitively, taking in through the senses and interpretations ideas and experiencing them and so forth and knowing in that way is not certain either. So where do we get certainty? Where is that going to come from? And rationalism basically ran its course. It had pretty much run its course by the 18th century. Empiricism embraces the uncertainties. And what you wind up with is you wind up with a general philosophy of relativism. We don't know for sure. I mean, you know, deductive reasoning will give you a much more clear logical conclusion, but only about certain things. Inductive reasoning gives you a sort of a in the ballpark conclusion. So where do you settle down into absolutes? Where are the standards? Where do you say this is a fact? This is right. This is the truth right here. And in human thought, you're just not getting that. It's always elusive. And so all of the philosophers are continually being frustrated by this idea that they're not able to actually settle in on truth. And so at some level or another, philosophical thought, modern philosophical thought, has had to settle into a comfort zone with relativism. Now, what is relativism? Relativism, you know, you can play a little word game with this if you want to. Relativism is the law that there is no certainty. All right, there is no absolute. Now, is that an absolute law of relativism, or is it a relativistic law of relativism? Is it absolutely true that all things are relative, or is it only relatively true that all things are relative? All right. And so you see what the problem is, and some people would call that a semantical problem. But understand that semantics have meaning. And so it is a contradiction. It's a contradiction in terminology. It's like saying there's an exception to the rule, including that rule, all right? Which means that there's an exception to the rule that there's an exception to the rule, which means that there's no exception to the rule. Well, it is a word game. But it's more than a word game. It's a meaning game, all right? And where these contradictions take place, we can't accept those things. Now, you know, how does relativism work out? Let's think back for a minute about that environment that man loves so much. What is it? Chaos. He loves nebulosity. He loves ambiguity. He likes for things to be uncertain and unclear. And so even though our rational systems have taught us that things cannot be nailed down in any kind of certainty, remember this, we're not okay with that, all right? In other words, that's all right. It's okay. We never really wanted certainty anyway. We always wanted some fudge room. We like some play in everything that we do. Because if an ethic ever shows up, if a moral ever shows up, then we want to make sure that we're going to be able to deal with it, okay? And if it is couched in an absolute certainty, then we can't deal with it. We just have to obey it. In this sense, people never really grow up. You know how children are. They're always looking for some sort of a slop room in everything that you're trying to tell them to do. And we don't get over that throughout our entire lives. We're always looking for that slop room. But we can only have that in a nebulous environment of thought, a relativistic environment of thought. Man has always been comfortable with that. But what does it do? It opens up the possibility that we really don't quite know anything. Let me illustrate that to you. You take an object, for instance, just any object, and you put that object before you, and there's a number of questions you can ask about the object. Number one, is this what it is? Because between here, the object, and here, the subject, there's a gap. And what I have to do is I have to transmit here, through the senses, the play of light upon this and the reflection of the play of light upon this into my eyes, through the optic nerve, to the brain where it's interpreted to tell me the identity of what this is. However, between what I have here, which is what I'm experiencing right now, I'm experiencing this, but not there. I'm experiencing it here. All right? Between here and here, there's a gap. And what's the difference between this and this? And this is where the whole relativistic problem comes in. Is this what it is? How much filter have I done? How much interpretation has taken place until it's gotten here? Well, you know, in most cases, we're close enough to the reality of the object, okay, to use it and to do with it what we need to do. But what if things get a little bit more abstract? Then it becomes less clear. What if things get to be more distant? Then it becomes less clear. All right. The bottom line about that is that I'm not really sure what this is, not with absolute certainty. Now, I can show it to you, and we can all agree that this is a bottle of water, and we use them right now. Christopher Lee is using one right now. And at least I think he is. It's at a distance from me, so I think that was a bottle of water. It might not have been. You know, there's a big gap between the object and the subject here, see. But here's where the problem is. The problem is between that which is and that which is perceived and interpreted. Where is the true reality? Is reality out there or is reality in here? And this is the relativistic problem right here. And we choose to believe it's here. This is where what we have done is we have drawn the world into ourselves. And that's what we like to do because it makes us gods, all right? And we would prefer to do that than to deal with objective reality. Does this sound familiar? Remember Socrates? Remember the theory of forms? Remember how it is that the thing that you see is only a shadow, but that the universal, which we are now drawing into ourselves, is here. It's not some other transcendent world. The transcendent world is here. Now, let me stop for just a minute and say this. Where did we begin this whole discussion? Days ago, when we were back in the mythological era, where did we start all this with? We started it with a rebellion against God in here, all right? It's always in here. It will never leave here. This is why rationalism is supreme and king. We have always believed that what's in here is where reality is. And not only that, but we've drawn the world into here so that we really are not as concerned about the object as we are about the subject. And this is the basis of empiricism. It's the basis of relativism. Where is reality? Is it out there in God's world? Or is it in here where we perceive it? And as individualists, we would prefer for it to be here. Because each one of us wants to be his own world creator. And so this is what relativism does for us. And so if this is true, then how do we know anything? For instance, how do you know when you are? When you are. Let's talk about time for a minute. When is the past? Well, the past is those things that have gone by. When is the future? Well, it's those things that are to come. Where are we? We're in neither one of those places. Where are we? We're in the present, but where is the present? Where is that point of the present where it is not future and it is not past? And you see, our existence is supposedly in that very place. Where I am at this very moment, which is that even as I talk, moments are flying by, seconds are flying by into the past constantly. Other moments are arriving and then passing on by. And in time, where do I exist? Where am I in time? Where am I in space? Everything's in motion, and not just one motion, but many motions at the same time. We are atoms moving. We're moving in a planet spinning, and one that's going around the sun, and a sun that's going around whatever it's going around, which is going around whatever it's going out around. There are just all these continual motions taking place at the same time. Where is hither and thither? Where is that which was, that place where we were, and that place that we're arriving to? And we're supposed to be here. But where's here? Same problem with the present, right? And so we don't even know where we are, and we don't know when we are. And here we are trying to figure out whether that bottle of water is out there or is in here. This is the problem of relativism. It's a very old problem. It's been dealt with by men for thousands of years. The Hindu put it this way. Krishna is sitting on a lotus blossom and he is dreaming everything. Life is but a dream. Row, row, row your boat, okay? So this is the end result of relativism. All barriers break down. All clarity breaks down. There is no focus. Everything's fuzzy. It's reflected in the art forms. Y'all may like to go to the Museum of Art and see Monet. It's usually on. It's usually. I think there's Monets over at the High Museum of Art a lot of times. So you can go over there and look at a Monet. And Monets are very interesting because they're impressionistic, and they're fun. Right? You stand off at a distance and you see a boat on the water. But you go walk up to it and you can't see anything. It's just a blurb of a bunch of colors right in front of your face. Put your face right up to, not right up to it, but get near enough to it, and all clarity goes away. This is a relativistic depiction here. It's the idea of the lack of clarity. And that's a fun thing, and Monet was very good at doing that too. But it is a philosophical idea. This is something that he was presenting to us. This breaks down into all kinds of things, in pointillism and in fragmentism in art. All of these kinds of depictions, various perspectives of art, like with Picasso. And Picasso actually was a very good artist. In spite of everything that you see hanging up on the wall, you may look at it and say, wow, my 4-year-old could do that. No, your 4-year-old couldn't do that either, because your 4-year-old doesn't think like Picasso. Picasso is trying to depict to you the various perspectives that there are on any particular thing. So in other words, when you look at a Picasso, you're looking at, two, three, four people looking at something at the same time. And that's the reason why everything's so odd there. You see this in surrealism and so on. These are philosophical depictions of how we perceive reality without clarity. All right. We think that when we see things, we're seeing it exactly as it is. Is that true? What about a duck? Okay, think about it, the way a duck sees things. You know, a duck is flying over and it's looking down and it sees trees, you know, and it's following some kind of path to somewhere, because it goes somewhere and it comes back and does it kind of the same way all the time. And its eyes are engineered for green. And it sees greens as vividly as we do colors. And somehow or another, and its world is a world of green. What about a crab? A crab can't see things. All it can see is motion and pixelations. Bugs that have mosaic vision, compound eyes that see lots and lots of the same thing. And the purpose of that is for them to be able to pick out motion and to be able to triangulate on direction and things of that sort. There are a lot of ways to perceive. We know that in the animal kingdom. There are heightened senses of smell, heightened senses of hearing, and so forth. And so ours, and we know that a lot of our senses are not as good as animal senses. What if they were? Then how would we perceive the world? Would it be with more or less precision in this or that? And so, you know, philosophers think about things like that. And when they think of these kinds of things, they go, you know, really, in many ways, we're blind in the universe. Think about the spectrum or spectrography for a minute. How much of spectrography can we actually perceive with our senses? On a band of spectrography that's that wide, we can only perceive about that much of it. And yet there's reality on both sides of it, going way beyond ultraviolet and infrared. Those waves from microwaves to macrowaves are changing into all different kinds of things as they're running down the line. And yet we can only really center in on this tiny little band here that we call light. How much of reality do we not see? Most of it, maybe, in many ways. Things that dogs can hear, we can't hear. Now, why do we say all this? Because these are philosophical ideas. These are things that come out of scientific discovery, you know, and we come to find out that the world that we're in is not as knowable as we think it is. It's not as observable to our senses as we think it is. How much are we missing in all of that? And what's the point of the whole thing? Lack of certainty. Lack of certainty. And what does that do to how we interpret everything? It causes us not to ever draw a concrete conclusion. You know, this whole non-confrontationalism, non-judgmental thing, it all comes out of this idea that everything's fuzzy, everything's muddy, nothing is really quite clear. So don't settle down to anything too much. Now, how does the Christian get past that? There's the big question right there. Because we believe in absolutes. And we believe that those absolutes have absolute certainty. They are unchangeable. There is no way in the world that they can change. Why? Because they're centered in God, and God Himself is immutable. And what the Christian has done is the Christian has escaped from the world and has, by faith, given himself over to the maker of the world, who perceives of the world, all of it, in every way, physical, metaphysical, the whole nine yards. He knows every bit of everything that he's made, not only in substance, but also in essence as well. God understands his world. He understands it well enough to be able to control it. And that's very important to us. We don't want to be deists. Because the one thing that we need to understand is that a world that controls itself is a logical impossibility. Besides which, if you're a relativist, how do you know that it is capable of running itself? You can't settle in on that. And if the natural state of all physical, of all of the physical universe is nothingness, and how do I know that? How do I know that the natural state of all things is nothingness? Because that's what everything came from. And without God to sustain it, what is the natural thing that the physical universe will do? It will return to that, to where it came from. It will go back to nothingness again. All right? We see little examples of that in the world under curse, corruption. If God withdraws some of his grace, things begin to corrupt. They begin to start to turn back. Even the prophets talked about it in that way when they talked about the world being without form and void. They're going all the way back to creation and saying, as God withdraws his grace, the world begins to go back to its watery, abysmal form again. And the next step from there is into nothingness. God can't forget about the universe. If he ever forgets about the universe, it ceases to exist. Because he must sustain existence. And he must sustain existence forever. That's the only alternative that we have. We don't have the alternative of thinking things will run itself. Hopefully it won't run down too soon, you know. If the sun burns out, it won't be for 10 billion years and I won't be around by then anyway, so it doesn't matter, all right? We can't, you know, as Christians, we know, we have the absolute standard of Scripture to tell us that God is in control of things. There are absolutes. There are certainties. We can stand on these things. Now, when we accept that, we are also accepting at the very same time that there is a responsibility that comes to us in those absolutes, such as law, moral law. And we have to be obedient to those things. But the nice thing about providence and the nice thing about the sovereignty of God in providence is this. And watch carefully. I don't have to know that any object is exactly what it seems to be in my mind. I don't have to know that. God knows this, and God knows this. He is the observer, not me. Okay? This is the missing element in rationalism. God is the observer, not me. I take His word for everything. All right? Now, without God, relativism is exactly, that is, if there could be no God and we could still exist, which that's not possible. But without God, relativism would be the state of mind that we would have to live in. We would never know anything. We would never have no certainty about anything whatsoever. But with God, we have certainty, not only about things in this world that are physical, which, you know, the nice thing about being a Christian is that we can sit around here and we can talk about relativism, and we can talk about when am I and where am I and what is the gap between me and the object and what do I do with it in my mind and all of those kinds of things. And we can sort of laugh about it and so forth, and it's not serious to us because we're not that woman who's writing Fontenelle a letter because she's afraid she's going to fly off the planet. We trust in God, and so therefore we have certainty about the reality of the world that we live in, and so we live in it comfortably. We live in it comfortably because what is. The chair that you're sitting in right now, it really is there. You're not floating in space. You know, we're not in some altered state. Krishna is not dreaming us on a lotus blossom. We're here. We really are here. I'm not all alone in the world just thinking you all are out there and dreaming about you. You're there. You're laughing. You know, you're laughing again, you know, and again. All right, see? Because this is the world we as Christians live in. We live in a world of reality. God's reality, not our reality. Certainly what's here doesn't represent everything that's out there. But do I really care? No, I really don't care. This apparent reality which I have is good enough. Why do I know that? Because God said so. And God says to me, trust me. You're perceiving reality exactly the way I want you to. All right? Now, if He gave me some other eyes, I would see all kinds of things, and I might not like that too much. Or He can take away my eyes, and I would see nothing. If He changed us in some way so that we perceive reality in various ways, then that's His business to do. But because He made us human beings with the faculties that we have, He intends for us to perceive the world in the representation of exact reality which He means for us to have in order that we may understand Him better. And that's enough. Now, if the point of all of this is for me to fill my head up with all knowledge, then I'm not going to get anywhere. But if the point of all this is for me to know Him, I have all the faculties that I need for that. And I need to be satisfied with it as well. This is the Christian answer to relativism. It is, yes, it's true. We have filtered senses. We have interpretations. So what? This is still a bottle of water, and I can drink it. And if you want to be a relativist and not be so sure about that, then, you know, you can go suck your thumb in a corner somewhere and just get in a fetal position and don't ever come out of it again, you know. Because this is what we can do to ourselves. We can cave in on ourselves to the point to where we can't even function anymore. Christian's not going to do that because the Christian knows the world he's in and he's comfortable in the world he's in because he knows that God has made it and has made him to properly correspond to that world. And so that's our answer to that. Now, as we go forward from here, we're going to see the philosopher digging the hole even deeper for himself, even than that, if you can believe it. But he does, because there is an end to all this, as we know, and that is the way of death.